That's J.J. Johnson on trombone, starting a string of solos by great sidemen on his 1981 release, Concepts in Blue, featuring Clark Terry on trumpet, Ernie Watts on alto and tenor sax, Billy Childs on piano, Ray Brown on bass, and Kevin Johnson on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Tuesday, June the 14th, 2015, and a program I hope you'll find informative and provocative even today. The American Federation of Teachers made big news on July the 11th when its president, Randy Weingarten, a longtime friend and political supporter of Hillary Clinton, announced that the 1.6 million member union voted overwhelmingly to back the presidential contender. Well, there's been a lot happening since that endorsement. Our guest today, Dr. Thomas Pedroni, Associate Professor of Curriculum Studies and Policy Sociology at Wayne State University, and also the co-director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project, is here with us to explain what's behind the AFT endorsement and how the endorsement reflects a schism, not only within the union and its rank and file, but also with Clinton's professed record on education as a progressive. It actually betrays her right-wing agenda, and we'll get into that discussion now. You should know, of course, that Dr. Pedroni has been with us analyzing education policy, specifically coming out of Detroit, but having broader implications and applications across the country. And so it is great to have you once again with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Utrice. I'm so happy to be on with you again.
Thank you. Well, let's go behind this much vaunted endorsement. How is it ringing in your neck of the woods, in the world of educators?
Well, what I want to draw everyone's attention to is something that I think is a lot more profound and important to be paying attention to than just the statements that each of the Democratic candidates made on the AFT questionnaire. Because I think that when the argument is laid out for public consumption, the main thing we're hearing, certainly from those who support the decision of AFT and Weingarten to endorse Clinton, is that questionnaire. And I've read the questionnaires for all three candidates, Malley and Sanders and also Clinton. And, you know, to be honest, the candidates I was paying the most attention to were Sanders and Clinton. And when you read through their responses, they don't read that tremendously differently from each other. So if you were just to go by that, and I think that that is what Weingarten and her supporters in this move want us to do, then you would say, well, there really isn't much of a substantive difference, and maybe there is an argument to be made for supporting and endorsing Hillary Clinton. But if you look in the background, and I think you were already alluding to this, Utrice, there's a lot of history that each of these candidates have, and I want to spend a little bit of time drawing that out. And I think the most important thing to note is that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders represent the polar opposite sides of the Democratic Party spectrum. In fact, they represent perhaps at its most clear and most contrasting fissures within the Democratic Party that are not so new. They've actually been around for quite some time. And I want to lay those out in a couple different ways. One is to think about them in terms of their very different vision of the state. And by the state, I mean the federal government, I mean municipal governments, I mean states, as in we talk about the state of Michigan or the state of New York, the state operating at all of those levels simultaneously. And we've had a lot of good work in the sociology of the state to help us better understand how we've had a real paradigm shift in the way that in Western democracies, in Japan, other parts of Southeast Asia, certainly in the United States, we've seen a phenomenal shift away from something called a welfare state model, which was always very sort of anemic in the United States anyway, and towards something called a neoliberal or a managerial model of the state. And these are profoundly different from each other. And I want to talk about how Hillary Clinton represents one and how Bernie Sanders represents the other, and how if you really come to understand those things, you really will have a better understanding of just how different the two candidates really are in philosophy when it comes to a basic public good like education in the United States. So does that sound like a good launching point?
Sounds great to me.
Okay, great. So just to kind of map it out really briefly, and I know your listeners are very astute, and probably I'll try to just be brief because I know this will be just a bit of quick review. But the idea is that in these two different conceptions of the role of the state, when you compare the welfare state model or what other people have called the social democratic accord or social democracy, when you compare that to a managerial model or a neoliberal state or a post-welfare state, some people have called it, when you compare those two things to each other, they speak to a very different relationship between the citizen, the government, the economy, the culture, society. They couldn't be much more different in some ways. So you had an idea coming out of the Social Democratic Accord, something that social democrats believe at their core, or others call themselves democratic socialists, there are a variety of different spins on that, that there is a fundamental role that the state can and should play in managing some of the worst crises of capitalism. In fact, the reason why we have the Social Democratic Accord in the United States growing out of the New Deal and maybe even a little bit before and sort of culminating in the post-war years until maybe the late 1970s was this notion that this would actually help capitalism to survive, because if you didn't do this, there would be such unrest in the general populace that that there would be grave threats. And so the idea was, well, the state could play a mediating role in guaranteeing certain basic minimums to the populace, and also guaranteeing capital its ability to accumulate. So, you know, it's kind of like an impasse that worked, you know, sort of well for a long time. It didn't work well for everyone. It never worked well for African Americans, for LGBTQ people, for women, in part because it was based on a male, heterosexual, white, culturally white breadwinner model. But that's a different story for another time. I just don't want to romanticize the welfare state, the notion of the public. There were actually big differences in it. But Bernie Sanders is of that ilk. He is, and I say that in a very positive way, he is of that ilk in the sense that he believes fundamentally in the importance of the public sector in strengthening the a democracy and strengthening the ability of citizens to speak back to and take a piece of the living world away from capital. And it's tendency to encompass everything, whether it's labor or the land around us or whatever. So for someone like Bernie Sanders, there has always been and continues to be a deep faith in the public sector. Whereas the neoliberal critique that Hillary Clinton is so representative argues the very opposite. It argues that the reason we have such crisis in the U.S., crisis that began in the 1970s, a lot of people say, with the oil crisis and with stagflation in the United States, they say is because of the inefficiency of the public sector, that there's a need to save the public sector from itself by infusing a lot of different market mechanisms, whether that's into healthcare or prisons or education, you could name it. The idea is if you introduce a little bit more market there, then you do things like you break up the inefficiencies of the public, which they argue tend to be self-protective, tend to be about the interests of the public sector unions, like the teachers' unions. Now, how do we know that that is where Hillary Clinton is coming from? Well, she has a long record, but the easiest way to do it is just to go back to the crisis that the Democratic Party perceived after Mondale's loss and the ascendancy of Reagan. And really what the Democrats did then is they retooled. And who was their leader, who was a spokesperson for the Democratic Leadership Council, which symbolized this new neoliberal turn in the Democratic policy in opposition to its social democratic roots, in opposition to people like Bernie Sanders, who have always been a standard bearer? Well, again, the Democratic Leadership Council was the vehicle for bringing this idea of neoliberal managerialism into the center of the Democratic Party, so that you now see that everyone from Barack Obama to Bill Clinton, and this would include Hillary Clinton, are really well to the right of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was an important part of the ascendancy of that sort of model, and he did a lot of important ideological work and put a lot of the common sense pronouncements about what that model was to be. But it really comes to its ascendancy with the Clintons and with Obama and with a direction that has now completely marginalized the social democratic wing of the Democratic Party. It's still there, and Bernie Sanders is certainly a standard bearer for it. So how do they view education differently? Well, for a person like Hillary Clinton, for people who come from that side of the Democratic Party, who would align themselves with Democratic groups like Democrats for Education Reform, there is a full-faith belief in that the public sector is something that is in crisis, and I don't think many of us would disagree with that, but that it's in crisis because of its inefficiencies. And what do you do to an inefficient public sector, according to people from the Clintons' direction of the Democratic Party and Obama's as well? Well, you introduce those market mechanisms. So what you do is you introduce competition, so-called, into the system. And I want to always put that in there with a grain of salt, because so often what we see is that the rhetoric of competition is there, and really what you have is more of a cartel system where people in control are pushing the contracts and the consultant partnerships to particular favored players, and there's not really this idea of an efficient bid for a process that leads to the best bids on whatever service is being privatized. But so there's a strong belief that what we can do to make public schools more efficient, and this comes with the whole rhetoric that public schools are failing, but especially in the urban core, we look at the state of public schools, instead of saying, well, you know, it's not really surprising that the public schools aren't doing well in our urban cores, because that's where all the poverty is. That's where our tremendously obscene levels of childhood poverty are the most focused, especially in a city like Detroit, where childhood poverty is estimated to be at least 60%. They say, that's not what leads public education to be so poor in those particular jurisdictions. Instead, it's because of who has captured the public schools, who has a monopoly over the public schools. And they call it producer capture. They say the producers of the educational product, and they always speak in terms of products and commodities, they have a monopoly over that sector. And those teachers, for example, know, and those bureaucrats know, that they're going to get a paycheck regardless of the performance of their students. So the argument is that you have to introduce competition, because all of those teachers who are, you know, cast as being lazy and not as productive enough because they don't need to compete, because they know they have their job anyway, they need to be made to compete. And the way you do that is by putting a lot of charter schools and other privatized forms of schools into a district. And suddenly the idea is that those teachers will have to compete for their jobs. They just don't take them for granted anymore. They have to finally get off their duff, the idea is, and finally produce results for their urban students, right? So this describes, in a nutshell, we could also talk about the introduction of corporate philosophies into education, you know, business management philosophies, all of these things that have no record of success over the years, the last two decades roughly that we've used them, but have a tremendous amount of ideological popularity. It's really a faith-based version of education reform, but not faith in God, faith in money and the markets to do their magic all the time.
Whenever you see money, you would find interest by a Clinton, whether it's Bill or Hillary or both. But I just wanted to, this is so interesting that you're saying this, because I want to share with you a clip of Hillary Clinton. This is Hillary Clinton just 2 days after announcing her candidacy. She made a two-day trek into Iowa, and her first stop was at Kirkwood Community College in Monticello, where she met with students and educators, and she was fielding questions about her education policy. It is remarkable, based on what you just said, that this was among her responses. Let's listen.
Okay. Yeah.
Are we having a little difficulty accessing the clip here? Okay. I don't see that we're getting that clip. But in effect, what she said was that education is a non-family enterprise. What do you think that she praised Common Core, but she said that education is a non-family enterprise. I think we have it now. It's just 38 seconds. Let's listen to it.
Education system. And a lot of states, unfortunately, haven't had that, and so don't understand the value of, you know, a core, in this sense, a common core, that then, yes, of course, you can, you know, figure out the best way in your community to try to reach. But your question is really a larger one. How did we end up at a point where we are so negative about the most important non-family enterprise in the raising of the next generation, which is how our kids are educated? And
do you get any of does that not frighten you a bit? It's just 38 seconds, but you said yes. Volumes in those 38 seconds. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I would agree. Yeah, I do agree. So first of all, when she refers to non-family, what she's doing is she's giving a tip of the hat to anyone who argues that the family is the most important socializing role of any child or of our community, that it's foundational in that respect. But when she makes the arguments about Common Core and sort of gives less importance to local determination of education curriculum, you know, what I really want to speak to is the way that the versions of nationalized curriculum that we are being asked to accept at this time. And they, of course, argue it's not a really national curriculum, but we know that, you know, states are putting their great duress in a number of different ways to accept the Common Core, and that it really does end up being not even a de facto national curriculum. It simply is a federally based national curriculum, federally incentivized national curriculum. Now, if the national curriculum were just sort of very, very bare bones and said a couple things here and there, and that those things were of high quality, probably a lot of people wouldn't raise a lot of objections. But in places like Detroit and other places around the country, we know that exactly what has been effective in those moments when it's been allowed to take root is the ability of educators to tailor the curriculum to the particular local needs and circumstances and meaning maps and cultural resonances of their students. We know that that is what good teaching is when pedagogy and curriculum are determined dialogically between a teacher and a school and the community and its families and children. That's where real investment in learning comes, because learning is not a set of facts that you dump into someone's head, but is instead about a process of negotiating meaning with the world that takes into account everything about where the student or learner starts out, his or her cultural attributes, systems of meaning, prior knowledge, all of those sorts of things, what the issues are in the community that will make education such a relevant and empowering tool for the child, for the community in the first place. So another thing to mention is that this idea of national curriculum is also related to the de-skilling of teachers, because still today, and I hope this isn't an artifact, this doesn't just become some sort of relic a few years from now, we still train teachers not just to be clerics and do clerical work. We train them not just to take a curriculum out of a box and read it like a script to their students, but to actually be that professional node who is there, who is well prepared in the classroom with students, who can respond to students and build curriculum and assess the students and provide remediation for students and inspire the students based on her or his particular knowledge of the circumstance that he or she teaches in. I mean, the idea of a teacher is such a wonderful thing if it's left to its fullness, to have someone in a context of 20, hopefully 25 students. Unfortunately, in Detroit, it's more like 40 or 50 usually, to be able to be the one to guide this process of inspiring students to be hungry about the world around them. and to realize how much knowledge is the way forward to try to build the world that they deserve and that they can imagine. So it's a very different idea of a curriculum that comes from somewhere else. And a curriculum that comes from somewhere else, even at its best, would be de-skilling teachers and taking away that ability to be locally relevant. But we're not at its best. We know that the Common Core curriculum that we have is actually something that comes largely out of the heads of people like Bill Gates and other large foundation directors, people who are not educators, and that one of the side effects, seemingly, and most of us don't think it's a side effect, we think it's the main course, the main reason, is that it makes it possible for all kinds of software developers and curriculum developers to hawk their products and call them Common Core aligned so that they can tap into that resource of public education dollars, especially in our urban cores. So mine the bodies of Black and Latino, mostly low-income children for the per pupil dollars that they represent.
This is really why it is so puzzling that the head of a national union, knowing Common Core to be a huge problem for its own membership, opposed to it, you hearing, we just played Hillary Clinton, not only touting the value and praises of Common Core, but also saying how unfortunate it is that states are not embracing it and families are not embracing it. And then she calls education one of the most important non-family enterprise. The word enterprise, of course,
enterprise,
you address that as a commercial venture.
Yes.
But the non-family part, meaning that in these urban centers that you just talked about, it is her inclination that families really don't have a central role to play here. And this spoke to the point that you made earlier about education being essentially a commodity, a product.
Right.
So knowing all of these things, does it puzzle you that the head of the union finds that, that basically they can't wait to endorse a candidate with these views that are clearly incompatible even with the views of its own members? So what do you make of that? What could possibly have been the reason? And I'm looking at reports now from the education community, people saying absolutely not. In fact, from the Washington Teacher, we have columnist Candy Peterson writing an article published just yesterday, headlined, "Teachers Say No Freaking Way to AFT Endorsement of Hillary Clinton." And a lot of, that's the headline. Teachers say no freaking way to AFT endorsement of Hillary Clinton. So what could possibly have been the rationale, in your view, of this endorsement, knowing that this neoliberal stance that Hillary Clinton historically has taken on the issue of education, and specifically within that milieu, Common Core being a real tender spot for the membership of the union and for the broader community at large? What could have been the reason for this endorsement?
Yes, well, the first thing I need to say is that most good teachers swear like sailors, so we know they didn't say teachers. We know what they really said, right? I mean, they call themselves, and I hope I think I can say this, they call themselves the badass teachers, right? So they're not always that guarded with the tongue, thankfully. But then I also, to getting to the point of your question, I want to first also give a quick tip to your point about non-family. The vision I laid out of education is a very family vision of education. So I very much see your point. Rather than education being a commodity that comes from somewhere else, a product, it should, I listed all of those aspects, the community, the students, the family, the neighborhood, that all should be in dialogue with the construction of the curriculum and types of pedagogy. So yes, families are a very important part of the breathing life into what a curriculum should be in an everyday school context. Now on to the larger thing that you were asking about Weingarten and the specific endorsement by the AFT of Clinton. I mean, the first thing I want to start with is just the obvious, that our unions themselves have a deeply problematic history. And we see constantly within our unions a struggle for the soul of the union. So most of us who consider ourselves politically on the left, we know that we are fighting for our unions just as we're fighting for the Democratic Party. We have union leadership, and I believe Weingarten is an example of this, who have deeply problematic relationships to very powerful organizations. And oftentimes under claims of, well, we need a seat at the table, they do some very reprehensible things that their membership does not support at all. So we know, for example, that not only has Randy Weingarten been personally very friendly to Hillary Clinton, and of course we would all agree that a union should not make an endorsement based on a friendship, that there's a lot at stake in these kinds of decisions, but that she, besides being a friend of Hillary Clinton, is also a very close friend of the Broad Foundation, and has a long history with the Broad Foundation, which is one of the chief architects of this corporate education reform, neoliberal education reform that is dismantling public education, particularly for urban Latino and African American and other children. We know that unions are struggled over in that way. A perfect example is in Chicago, right, where a slate that had governed for quite a long time was finally defeated by the core slate that Karen Lewis was the head of, is the head of. And so our unions are themselves an object of struggle. And this, and for all of the AFT membership that is very upset, and I'm also a part of the AFT AAUP, so we have an affiliation with the AFT here at the university as well. We know that part of the struggle is to put in the right leadership. And this is one more example that I think should shake our faith in leaders like Randy Weingarten, who sometimes says the right thing to appease the membership. But I think when it comes to really high stakes things like this, and you mentioned everything that comes with this in terms of Common Core and even merit pay, VAM, value added measurements, ways of evaluating teachers. I don't know how much your audience is familiar with these ideas. But value-added measurement as a way of evaluating teachers, and what that means is it's a form of merit pay, or at least it lends itself to that. It lends itself to high-stakes decisions about hiring, firing, and promoting teachers. It's based on the belief, and it turns out it's a very magical belief, that you can determine a teacher's quality, their value-added, in an educational context by measuring the growth of their students over a course of a year. And it all sounds so good because we know when we see numbers, we think we're dealing with real knowledge. The only problem that the corporate education reformers, who, including Hillary Clinton and apparently Randy Weingarten, who have some faith in this, is the only problem they have is that empirically, the American Statistical Association, which I'm sure is regarded as the most respectable quantitative statistical association in the world, has said that it's basically junk science, and has said that teachers, even if when you're just talking about student growth over the course of a year, what teachers can do, and I believe very powerfully in teachers, otherwise I wouldn't be a teacher educator, that teachers only account for 1 to 14% of the growth that students make within the course of the year. And what is the box of all that other stuff? Well, it's the context, and especially the changing context of students' lives. So if you ask yourself, in what sectors of American society are students likely to see their socioeconomic fortunes increasing, and where they're likely to see them decreasing? And I think we all know the answer to that in the era of a shrinking middle class and increasing poverty, and some of the very wealthy who get even more wealthy, is that if you're a teacher who wants to, because of your commitment and your ability and your familiarity, your cultural familiarity, want to work in low-income African-American and Latino communities, working-class communities in their public schools, well, those are the communities that are being hit the hardest. So when you have at least 86% of that growth determined by factors that have nothing to do with the teacher, but with the social structure, the socioeconomic structure in the background, then that creates a huge disincentive for quality teachers to be teaching in neighborhoods like that, in public schools that need them the most, you could argue, as if there weren't enough disincentives already in place there. There are perverse incentives, and we could think that maybe the architects of these philosophies, these ideas, aren't aware of them, but I'm often fearful that it's exactly the point. I mean, it really strikes me as someone who works within the field of, the social sciences, when you see government policy at such a large scale with so much money behind it, ignoring and just pushing away the evidence of the American Statistical Association, as if that's some sort of left-wing enterprise, there's that word again, in the pockets of the teachers' unions. You know, please, it's not. That's hardly their affiliation. It just represents science. I've always loved how the defenders of No Child Left Behind, like Arne Duncan and others, have always said that they believe in evidence-based practices, you know, that we need to follow evidence-based practices. Yet they have a total, utter, shameful disregard for anything that's evidence-based. All of Arne Duncan's strategy of school turnaround never had any evidence and still have no evidence that supports them.
We've discussed Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, as a person in need of an education. He is hardly academically qualified for the job, but it seems to have been, as the Clintonite way of doing things. You get people who just you want put in a particular position, and Arne Duncan, as well as Hillary Clinton, both were the products of that kind of thinking. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and giving us a wonderful lesson here about education and the things that motivate education policy and even political endorsements on education. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I look forward to you joining us again soon, because we want to continue the discussion that we began about re-examining this thing that we call education and education policy in the United States. Thanks so much, Thomas Pedroni, Associate Professor of Curriculum Studies and Policy Sociology at Wayne State University and co-director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jess. Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll take this break, and when we come back, the Garner family settles a chokehold case. It's a case of money talking and justice walking. Right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. The family of Eric Garner has agreed to settle a threatened $75 million lawsuit against the city of New York for Garner's police chokehold death on July the 17th last year. The family will accept a $5.9 million payout, and the city, in exchange, admits no liability for the actions of Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who placed Garner in the banned chokehold, nor would it accept liability for any other city employees involved in the fatal encounter. Seems to me, as we have been contending all along on this program, this is a case of money talking and justice walking. A couple of notations here. I do not blame the family at all. This is they're not in charge of the litigation here. They don't have that kind of expertise and authority, really, to engage in litigation. But we clearly see the hand here, of the handiwork of the people handling this case, the Sharptons of the world, the the Benjamin Crump, the original attorney brought into the case, the other attorney, Sanford Rubinstein, who had been sidelined on the matter of an alleged rape charge and replaced by the new attorney. But what we are seeing here is the direct offense when we called it on this program, where we have these bone collectors, these people who seize upon these kinds of cases, awful tragedies for the families concerned, and they use these cases primarily not for justice. There is no indication anywhere along the line that this was a fight for justice. I said it repeatedly on this program. I told you repeatedly what this was about. It was about arriving at a settlement where the family of Eric Garner, the representatives for the family, will sit on one side of the table and the city's representatives will sit on the other side. And the conversation would be, what is a dead Eric Garner worth? How much would it take for you to say yes? And let us get this matter over with. And yes, we're sorry he's dead. Blah, 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 blah. That's over it. Let's move on. It's a new day. However, just yesterday, I went down a list of all the things that have happened. Everybody has proceeded in one way or the other, but no indication at all that the justice system is at work. It hasn't worked. And it was designed that way. And we have the Sharptons of the world and the Benjamin Crumps of the world encouraging all of this public activity, the outpouring of public support, the demonstrations in the street, the activism, all designed to strengthen their hand at the settlement table. The matter of justice here, not only for Eric Garner, but for the Eric Garners of the United States, is out the window. No movement there at all. And in order for them to, quote, move forward, the aggrieved family, through its representatives, its legal representatives, the aggrieved family will now have to say, we absolve the city of any blame. Do you understand this? As the ultimate betrayal, not only of the family's interests, but of the interests of the class of people represented by Eric Garner. People being dispatched in all these different ways by police departments, members of police departments all across the country. That is the central question. And here's why it's really offensive that they settled this case. You did not have any confusion here. It's a litigator's dream. There was no confusion here as to what happened. It was on tape. The whole world saw it. We saw Eric Garner murdered on tape. That's what we saw. There's no confusion about that. So why did this case not end up in a court of law where, as a litigator, I'm not an expert, but I would suggest to you that any litigator would have been chomping at the bit to insist on a trial. This case should have gone to trial. All of the evidence is there, but look at all of the resistance along the way. Alton Maddox and I, we discussed this at length. We told you chapter and verse of how these things go, so as to produce the desired result. And the desired result in this case is that there is going to be no record of liability by the city and its employees for the death, the murder of a civilian. And certainly it is not going to happen when that civilian happens to be African American or Latino. It ain't going to happen. And they saw to it, and they had the cooperation of the Sharptons, of the Benjamin Crumps, and now of the new lawyer handling this case. This is insane. And all of that energy, all of this goodwill, all of the concern, the people taking to the streets because they were asked to, because they were asked to show up, because this was about justice. This was about forcing the system to deal with this matter. There was no confrontation planned with the system at all. We said that. We said that. But this is how it's done. We've been talking about systems and how they work, how they are manipulated to produce a desired result. And this is how it works. You want to sue for $75 million? Certainly, again, I would have taken the chance as a litigator. If I were a competent litigator, I certainly would have taken the chance that this absolutely must go to trial. You have the recorded evidence. And by the way, the man recording the evidence, Ramsey Lauder, is the only person who so far has been prosecuted in this case on completely extraneous charges, in order to get him out of the way. This is outrageous. And people should understand that these litigators and the people like the so-called advocates like Sharpton, the civil rights leaders who come in and whatnot, this is supposed to be the time when they're supposed to be made to explain their roles in railroading justice. The officer that killed this man still has had no charges against him. The city is being allowed to get through the trap door. And the aggrieved family, under the terms of settlement, will have to hold the city harmless in order to get $5.9 million. So justice is out of the picture. It's now a raw situation of how much money are we going to get? What do you want to give us for our dead husband and father? I would venture to say, if this case had come to trial, as it should have, but we know what happened. We know that the prosecutor failed to secure an indictment against Officer Pantaleo. We also know that Officer Pantaleo is not the only person implicated in this case. We had, as I described yesterday, we had at least two sergeants, six officers. We had several members of the emergency medical team that responded. All of these are players in the death of Eric Garner. But instead of fighting, instead of really putting the system on trial, they spent months and months and months of negotiating in order to see how much money the city would actually be serious about offering, and the role of the new attorney, Jonathan Moore, the role of the new attorney is to persuade the family that it's a better deal than actually going to trial. So let's not raise any more dust. The city says, you want $75 million? The city says, we're going to pay you 5.9. We're prepared to pay you that and nothing higher. And what do you have to say? Well, these people are not experts at law. These are just regular people thrust into a horrible situation. They're looking for guidance and getting it from the wrong people who have the wrong motives. On the backs of their dead husband, the back of their dead husband and father, a whole bunch of people are getting exactly what they want. We discussed the whole cast of characters yesterday. Everybody's getting everything they want. But the central question here, which is what everybody ought to want, is justice. And we're not getting that. That's out the window. Give them 5.9 million. They have to agree that the city is not going to admit any liability at all, not even for the death of their own husband and father. And their advisors are telling them this is the way to go because it's about money. Give them some money, they'll soon go away. The whole matter will become, in short order, a distant memory. And that's the bottom line. And that's why I call them collectors of bones. This is their stock in trade. They transform tragedy into an opportunity to make money, to gain a higher or larger profile, public profile, and to deceive the public about its legitimate concern and interest in justice. They, in fact, cooperate with the system in order to subvert justice. So, what are we to do? Well, from this point onward, a litmus test has to be developed with public transparency. Individuals who find themselves and their families in these predicaments have got to plainly state whether theirs is a quest for justice or for money. You can't really cover this stuff up anymore. Families who choose to treat these situations as private situations, as private matters, are entitled fully to proceed as a private matter. Hire your private attorney, do your private thing in private with all kinds of privacy that you want. But the minute you come public and the minute you plead with the public for its political support and its support in other ways as well, to demonstrate to a power structure that you are involved in a struggle for justice, you will now be required to fulfill the expectations of that. I remarked all along, we have never seen any legal papers that suggest that these lawyers were in any way interested in taking on the system. We didn't hear about a special prosecutor out of the mouths of any of these folks. It didn't happen until, well, it was unavoidable. But by then, it was almost, the year was almost up. Similarly in Ferguson, the same group, same tactics, same results. So here we got to get real too. If this is about money, you proceed accordingly. You hire your lawyer and you do your thing. But when you come public and you tell people this is about all of us and we need you in the street and we need you to do this and we need you to do that, and people are doing it because they think they are supporting a just cause, a cause for justice. They're putting themselves on their line, on the line, risking arrest. They are invested because they understand that this is an issue that affects us all as a group of people, as a class. They're thinking you're interested in class action. They think you're interested in really confronting the system and forcing it to change and exacting concessions that are long overdue and that you have a right to by law. They think you're interested in a fight, a real and genuine fight. But as I said repeatedly on this program, check the record. All along, we were getting very different messages. And again, I exempt the family. I exempt the family from this. They're caught in a situation. They don't know how the system works. They don't know the courts. This is not their milieu. They're relying on the wrong people who give them the wrong advice for the wrong reasons. And we end up with the wrong consequences, the wrong results. And this is what we have come to. Now, these speeches made about, well, you know, justice is still being pursued and blah, 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 blah. Our attitude should be, we have seen your spots. We know who you are. We know the kind of animal you are. We know the kind of beast you are. You're the money beast. You are a collector of bones. You are a predator of the community. We understand that. We got you clear. We got you. We know you. We know what you're about. You are no longer a mystery to us, nor are your motives. And from this point on, we make it clear that when these things happen, the family itself must be aware of what it means to ask the public support. If they're not up to fighting, then hold everything nice and private and don't bother anybody. Go about your business and let people go about theirs. And that is what I have to say. I recommend that you go to the archives and you look for all those programs that we did. Alton Maddox and I, we kind of laid out the landscape here and predicted precisely in the Garner case, as well as in the case of Michael Brown and Ferguson, we predicted precisely what was going to happen, explained to you exactly why. And we were absolutely on point. Because this isn't the first time this has happened. And it will continue to happen unless people decide to change their attitudes and say, hey, we're not chumps. We're not people who are going to be used at your whim to achieve your rather clandestine aims. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I hope this program was meaningful to you. You can let me know at leadstories@gmail.com. Stay tuned, keep it right here. The Infectious Myth with David Crowe is up next. You want to stay tuned for that. As always, a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.